If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. This is the Freeman Report with your host, James Freeman, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is James Freeman, and this is today's Freeman Report here on today's News Talk TNT. So what did you think of me and Rick Munn on Muckrakers in the previous hour? I have to say, I think the format has got lots of potential. And I guess if you're wondering about that name, probably like you, I thought, what the hell is that when I first heard it? Well, listen to this and it will all make sense. The Muckrakers were a group of reform-minded journalists, writers and photographers in the progressive era in the United States, which was between roughly 1890 and 1920. The Muckrakers claimed to expose corruption and wrongdoing carried out by the establishment, often using sensationalist publications to gain attention of their work. These days, the term is occasionally used to reference investigative journalists in the US and refers to those who do dig deep for the facts that highlight scandals. Now, that should sound very familiar to viewers and listeners of TNT because many of the hosts on this station are muckrakers on steroids. We seek the facts that reveal the truth, and then we shout about it from the rooftops, focusing in on the most damning aspects of what we've found. We ring the alarm bell to warn the public of corruption and wrongdoing by those in power. And we're fearless in our pursuit. Because let's be honest, if nobody carries this mantle, then good people suffer and evil people prosper. That is what our new show, Muckrakers, is all about and why the show is called what it is. Right then, on to today's Freeman Report. First up, I'll be speaking with former head of London Transport Police, Tony Thompson. Interestingly, Tony was first on the scene of the Clapham train crash disaster, which occurred on the 12th of December 1988, after a crowded British Rail passenger train crashed into the rear of another train that had stopped at a signal just south of Clapham Junction Railway Station. 35 people died in that collision and 484 were injured. So I expect that that experience, if you experience that being a first responder, that will change your life. It will stay with you for the rest of your life. And I guess based upon his experience of that day, Tony has gone on to fight many injustices, including the Grenfell fire disaster. Today, we're going to talk about key evidence that was withheld from defence lawyers in the Birking murder of a vagrant that resulted in Clive Freeman spending 35 years in prison. He's no relation of mine, by the way. But yeah, this poor guy, it sounds like at the face of it, he spent 35 years in prison when potentially he is innocent of the crime. And then to finish today's show, I'll be speaking with Doug Bando, who's a journalist and foreign policy and civil liberties expert. He's also a senior fellow at the Washington-based Cato Institute. We'll be discussing the Iranian regime and its civil liberties abuses. And I'll be asking what the likelihood is of the people of Iran ever overthrowing their government in our lifetime. I'll also be asking Doug for his assessment of a statement put out by General Charles Q. Brown Jr., who is the chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff, after he said that NATO trainers will eventually be sent to Ukraine. I'm sure they're there already, but just not on an official capacity. But for me, this would signal a big escalation of the conflict because, you know, we have lots of cold wars around the world where basically Russia is fighting America, but they don't admit that's the case. They use proxies. So when America or Russia officially announce that their troops are there on the ground, well, that does escalate things quite significantly. But I'm keen to hear what Doug has to say about it all. Now, before we go over to our news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news, I would like to highlight a post that I published on X yesterday in response to a post by the British Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. In his post, Mr. Hunt said the infected blood scandal is the worst example of an establishment cover-up that I've ever seen. And I speak as a former health secretary who campaigned against many such cover-ups. Around 3,000 deaths and tens of thousands of lives have been ruined because of accountable people in power and the fact that they refuse to admit that they got things wrong. Shocker. Now, I couldn't let Mr. Hunt get away with that claim, so I posted a reply pointing out the COVID jab cover-up, pointing to my interview with Doc Malik last Friday. Now, that reply to the British Chancellor's post has now had more likes than the Chancellor's original post. So, if you're on X, I've got a request for you. Get over to the platform. First of all, follow me if you're not following me already, James Freeman, and help me make it clear to the British Chancellor that nobody believes his statement, given that he is part of a current cover-up, which is much, much bigger than the infected blood scandal. So please get over there now and support that post, because it must be a hell of an embarrassment for the British Chancellor to put out a statement like that, only to be ratioed by the likes of me. If you want to get in touch, then please email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And if you want to join in the conversation, get yourself over to tntradio.live and click on the chat icon. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk TNT.
Talk that matters.
For once, we just need to do what's best for this damn country and not what's best for the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right then, over to our UK news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news. What have you got for us, Gemma?
Well, there's a lot going on. The infected blood scandal, the HIV and hepatitis C blood scandal, is one of the dominating stories. I'll get to that in just a minute. But it's just emerged that one person is dead and seven people has been injured after a flight that took off from London's Heathrow Airport on its way to Singapore was caught in severe turbulence. Flight SQ321, a Singapore Airlines flight to Singapore, was forced to make an emergency landing in Thailand. It had 211 passengers on board, 18 crew. It's not known how many of those were British or whether the dead person is British, but that is a breaking story. Also, another breaking story from this morning, a woman is seriously ill in hospital after being stabbed outside a primary school in Luton in Bedfordshire, just north of London. A man has been arrested. The woman is seriously ill in hospital. She was stabbed outside Beech Hill Community Primary School at drop-off time this morning, school drop-off time. Police remain in high presence around the area for reassurance, but they've assured the public they don't think there's any wider threat to the community. And back to the infected blood scandal, the biggest story absolutely in the UK today. The government minister has been setting out in the House of Commons details for the compensation scheme for people infected with HIV and hepatitis C during the 1970s and 80s with contaminated blood here in the UK. A compensation package likely to exceed the 10 billion that was earmarked. And Minister John Glenn says it's not just those that were given the blood that deserve to be compensated, but family, partners, children and friends who were also affected. And if people have died, then the compensation will go into the deceased's estate if they died from the infected blood, which means it will go to their relatives. And some interim payments, because people are dying at such a fast rate now from the infected blood, will begin within the next 90 days. Some people to receive £210,000 of interim payment in compensation. And it will all happen before the next general election, James.
Yeah, I mean, on that look, it's absolutely devastating what has happened to people. Lots of people died. And then relatives that have, you know, it's changed. Even the people that weren't directly affected, it has ruined families. It has ruined people's lives. I think it's absolutely right that the British government give decent compensation to these people. But my real problem with all of this, as usual, is nobody seems to be held to account. You know, we've seen it with the post office scandal. So far, somebody's lost their, well, I don't know whether it was a knighthood, Gemma, or, you know, it was certainly an honorary title, the CEO of the post office. But really, is that enough? You know, this is criminal, what has happened. People knew what was going on at the time after a certain period. And certainly later on, politicians knew, they covered it up. That is surely a crime. It should be, at least. I know corporate manslaughter laws didn't come in until after the actual scandal. But that's my real issue with that, Gemma. But I want to hear more about this story with this woman being stabbed outside of school. Are there any more details on, you know, I hate to ask this question, on the nationality of the person who stabbed this poor lady?
No, what I've brought to you is all the details that we had. This story broke a few hours ago that somebody had been, police were called to this primary school in Luton in Bedfordshire after reports of a stabbing incident. At that point, it wasn't clear whether it was a stabbing incident inside the school or outside of the school. But all the details that I have on this one are the details that I've just brought to you. We don't know the nationality. We don't know the relationship of the man to the woman, if there is a relationship, or whether it was a random attack, or did they know each other. Police said a man has been arrested. Nobody's been charged yet. Police are keeping a wide presence outside the school and the surrounding area. There was no suggestion that any children were involved or in danger in this, but it was school drop-off time and she was stabbed near the school. So that we do know, but there's no other detail that's been released yet. Obviously, if this man is charged, we will know the name and the age and possibly the address of the person. That will be it. And then we won't be able to say much anyway after proceedings become active. But that is literally all we know. But of course, it is another stabbing incident very quickly after the back of the East London stabbing incident in Hainault, where a 14-year-old boy was tragically killed. A man has been charged with murder and attempted murder in that incident. And it does just show still the prevalence of knife crime and how difficult it is to keep tabs on who's got knives and where people get knives and the danger of knives. That is our big issue in UK crime. It's not guns, it's knives. And this is another story in quick succession on top of other stabbing stories that we've seen. So hopefully there won't be some detail on this in tomorrow's show if somebody's been charged. But that is all we know at the moment, James.
Yeah, Gemma. I mean, look, there's lots of reasons for this stabbing. Some of them are terrorist motivated. Some of them, it's clearly people with mental health problems for various different reasons, whether they're in a country that they're alienated from, whatever. We don't know the background, but this is a sickness, I think, that we've got in the UK now. You know, we've seen even school children in Wales, a girl here stabbing a teacher. This is a sickness which has infected our society and we need to sort it out. I think, you know, we need to look at the sentencing. Because at the moment, for if you carry a gun, you get a minimum of 5 years. Whereas if you carry a knife, you get up to 4 years. So there's a maximum, but there's no minimum. Not really much of a deterrent, particularly when, you know, when you look at the actual sentences being handed out. I think it's about 7.5 months is the average sentence. So not really that much of a deterrent. I mean, of course, if somebody's got mental health problems and you know, they're just going on the rampage, it's not going to deter them anyway. But, you know, we need to start having more of a conversation. There's always outrage when these things happen. But we need to, I think the whole country needs to have a very big conversation about this, because it is a sickness, I think, in our society, Gemma.
Absolutely. And it wasn't long after the Hainault attack that the police were saying they issued the policing authorities lead officer on knife crime was saying how easy it is now because teenagers who shouldn't be buying knives at all were going on social media, TikTok, Snapchat, to buy knives from unscrupulous dealers who were not doing checks on whether these people were over 18 or any background checks at all, just selling these huge like zombie type knives and all kinds of knives on these huge social media platforms. And he wanted a massive government clampdown on that. So I think you're right. It has become a sickness wrapped up in some kind of weird fashion. I don't want to call it fashion trend, I think is a better word, for people to be buying these knives, acquiring these knives, something of a status symbol to go online and get them illegally, a lot of cachet surrounding that. But you're right. It illustrates a deeper underlying issue in our country and in our culture, and one that the police, you know, both within London, Greater London, and the surrounding areas around the country seem to fail to get a handle on and to be able to monitor it. We've done stories on the zombie knives here on TNT before. It is a growing issue and one for concern, as this morning's story just illustrates, that poor woman.
Yeah, and of course, like I said, we don't know the context of this, but look, You know, if you made a minimum sentence of 5, maybe even 6 or 7 years, there would be a change. People, you know, obviously, like I said, it's not going to affect somebody who's got mental health problems. There's going to be no deterrent for them. That is a different issue altogether. But these gangland knifings, which the majority are, particularly in London, people would be less inclined to carry around a knife if they thought they were going to be banged up with a minimum sentence that meant a minimum sentence. I guess the only other problem we've got there, Gemma, and this is a story we've heard in the past week as well, the prisons are full. So, yeah, what a mess. Exactly. What a mess.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much for that story, Gemma, and look forward to speaking with you again tomorrow. To the rest of you, my next guest is Tony Thompson. He is former head of London Transport Police. We're going to be talking about several things. Got some really interesting conversations coming up. So stay put right where you are, right here on TNT.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royd.
OpenAI says that it understands that the live images from your phone's camera and images that you share, as well as what it can see on your smartphone, tablet, or computer screen, if you decide to share that with ChatGPT. And there was an example that it gave where you can take a picture of a menu in a different language. And instead of just getting a text translation on screen, live on screen, with the free and very good Google Translate app, you can talk to ChatGPT for Omni, and it will translate the menu for you in real time. And if you wanted to, it will talk to you about the food's history and its significance, and even give recommendations on the meals on offer.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right. Well, I'm delighted to be welcoming Tony Thompson, former head of London Transport Police, to the Freeman Report for the first time. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Thank you, James. Nice to be on it.
Yeah, welcome. Now, Tony, we've got a couple of stories we're going to talk about today. I think there's this one with Clive Freeman that we're going to talk about. But I guess you're a really interesting guy. I did a bit of research this morning. You were first on the scene, weren't you, to the Clapham train disaster. Now, that happened many, many years ago now, back in 1988. So I don't want to talk about the actual train disaster as well. It's pretty horrific. But I'm really, really interested to hear from you, you know, if that changed the direction of your life, because to me, being a first responder on something like that must have been absolutely horrendous. So I do wonder, you know, what impact that had and if that is the reason why you've gone on to be a champion for injustices.
Well, the Clapham train crash, 12th of December 88, was at the was actually the first of about 10 I dealt with, all the major train crashes in the UK up to 2002. So I became a train crash specialist and disaster management, which is the area that I work in now. It was the second largest train crash since World War II. I think there was one in 1957. So I've dealt with a lot of death and destruction, and it's over the years. But it was through my work with the veterans, military veterans, that I came to meet Clive Freeman in prison in Layhill in Gloucestershire about a year, just over a year ago now. I've been dealing with Clive's case since then. But yeah, I have a big thing. I will speak out and challenge things I think that are unacceptable. You know, I did 32 years in the police, of which I think I did the best that I could. I always acted fairly, openly, and honestly. And there's no skeletons in my cupboard in relation to that. And when I came across Clive's situation, I initially couldn't believe how somebody could end up in prison now, 36 years, including the time when he was arrested in 88. But it's interesting, going back to Clapham, December 88, Clive had already been in jail or on remand 6 months by the time I dealt with this train crash. So trying to put a timescale on and understanding what he's gone through then is just quite mind-blowing.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that case in a minute. I guess what I was trying to get at, Tony, is what motivates you? Because it sounds like you've had a very, very successful and busy career in the police. So why didn't you just put your boots up and retire and go and sit in the sun or do the gardening? What drives you? Why do you feel the need to champion these injustices?
Well, I think I've got the experience and the knowledge in the background, and I'm not afraid. You know, through my police career, I've been involved in lots of difficult situations, so I'm quite happy to stand up and challenge government, challenge organisations, and challenge individuals if I think there's merit in doing so. So I suppose it's sort of developed over time. I mean, in the 32 years in the police, my whole rationale in terms of dealing with the crimes and offences was to establish the truth. You know, not to convict people who are innocent. So it's about, you know, establishing the truth and ensuring, you know, I took an oath of allegiance to the Queen as she was then, to uphold law and order. And that's what I strongly believe in. My grandfather spent similar amount of time, in fact, longer than me in the police. And I felt obliged to following in his footsteps.
Now, Tony, when did you actually leave the police, just out of interest?
Well, I left the police in 2002, but I'm still heavily involved in different aspects of it in terms of security. I chair a police history group, and I chair an international police association local branch in Somerset in the UK. So I'm still quite heavily involved in policing type issues, although I'm not a warrant card holder in that sense at the moment. So I'm promoting both the good and the bad sides of police history. You know, some things have not been handled all well, and it's about looking at the good, the positive, and also hoping that people will learn lessons and do the right thing.
And how would you, before we move on, because I very rarely have a senior policeman on the show, so I'm really interested to get your views, Tony. How, in terms of how police is changed, particularly since 2010, we saw a lot of experienced officers retired early there by the coalition government that came in. And I think there's been a lot of accusations in recent years that policing has moved to a very protocol approach, tick-boxing, essentially, rather than police being given the freedom to use their sort of intelligence about situations. What's your view? Would you agree with me on that? And what would your view be?
Well, you clearly, you know, you need processes and procedures, but we had processes and procedures, you know, when I was in place. They've developed over time. And of course, with more introduction of new technology and cameras, all the stuff that I didn't have initially when I joined. But police officers still have discretion. They have to work within the law. And, you know, and I speak to still a lot of police officers retired and serving across the country and internationally. And, you know, when I joined, I was told back in 1970, you know, the job's going downhill. And you still hear them talk about the job's going downhill. And I suspect that applies in lots of organisations. You know, I was sent out with lots of my colleagues at the time in 1970. I didn't have a radio. I had a wooden truncheon and a whistle, which was the same as my grandfather had. And yes, you have to rely on your how you manage difficult situations. If you're dealing with, you know, the angry man or angry woman, you know, without all the kit that you have to carry, which I ended up carrying, you know, before I finished. But, you know, discretion, treating people politely, properly, how you would expect to be treated as a member of the public. You know, that was my sort of mantra: deal with people properly and fairly. Even if it's somebody that's trying to knock your head off, you know, once you've calmed them down a bit and they realise what they're trying to do. But you know, I would do it again. I would do it again tomorrow if I had the opportunity. I'm now too old. I'm still pretty fit, but I'd do it again. I wouldn't replace it. There's a lot of, you know, you deal with the whole range. I'd be dealing with, you know, someone who's down and out, royal visits. I did a lot of stuff with security of VIPs and the royal family over the years. Football supporters, everything. Lots of death and misery as well, sadly. Not just with train crashes. There's a lot of issues with suicides. People that used to take their lives under tube trains and brainline trains. And you do the best you can, and I would do it again. I, you know, that Police officers today have got more equipment than they've ever had it before them to help them, whether it's tech, cameras, defensive weapons, protective equipment, and so on. So, I'd go out on the street now with somebody or my own. I wouldn't have any fear of doing that.
Well, I'm pleased you're still involved because you've clearly got a lot of experience going from literally having a whistle and a hat to watching how technology has changed policing, has had a revolution in policing. Now, Tony, we are going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but we're going to talk about Clive Freeman. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind just setting the scene before we go to that break so that we can carry on the conversation when we come back.
Right. In brief, and it's a really complex story that's been going on for a long time now, but in 1988, Clive was arrested in Australia, came back to the UK of his own accord, albeit with a police escort, and was convicted at the Old Bailey on the 2nd of May 1989, so 35 years ago, of an offence of murder and arson. And the allegation from the prosecution, or the offence for which he was committed, was that the police had this idea that he, or this belief that he was trying to execute a policy of insurance on his own life, and that we needed a body double, and he'd lured, this is what the newspapers were saying at the time, he'd lured a tramp back to a flat that he'd been temporarily staying in, killed him by a technique that he'd learned in the military that didn't leave any marks by suffocating him, set fire to the flat and the body, and then disappeared to Australia. Now, that was the basis of it. But as I found by reinvestigating the case, there's just so many things wrong with it. And here he is, 20 years beyond his tariff that he would have that he served, but because he's been protesting his innocence right back to the day he was arrested on the 2nd of June 1988 in Australia, he's been saying it wasn't me, I didn't do it. And in fact, all the evidence shows the person that died, and somebody did die, wasn't murdered at all. It was either misadventure because the person had drunk excessive alcohol and consumed medicinal drugs, or it was it was an accident, and a combination of natural medical causes. So the whole thing around the whole conviction is wrong.
Fantastic, a brilliant summary there, Tony. We're going to take a quick short break for the news headlines now. When we come back, I'd love to hear, because what you're saying there presumably is based upon facts, is based upon evidence. So I'd like to hear why that evidence wasn't taken into account in the first place. So we'll talk about that after this short break on TNT.
Okay, everybody, listen up.
Big news.
Big news.
Real big news.
Here we go.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a quick look at your TNT headlines. The US is threatening to punish the International Criminal Court after its chief prosecutor sought an arrest warrant for Israel's prime minister over alleged war crimes in Gaza. China's accused Washington of deliberately prolonging and profiting off of the war in Ukraine. And Australia's largest telecommunications provider, Telstra, has announced it's axing near 3,000 jobs as the company turns to AI.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Right. Now, Tony, murder trials are a serious thing. Lots of resources go into it. There's a whole court, usually at the High Court or a very, very important court, with experienced barristers and judges. And what you kind of indicated before the break there is evidence to suggest that what he was he was ruled to be murdered. I forget the exact words, but that's not the case, which means that evidence, that information must have been there at the time. Tell us about what went wrong, Tony.
Well, having looked at and spent months going through and poring over the evidence, because a huge amount of documentation goes into any trial, particularly a murder trial at the old Bailey in London, which is our top criminal court, I mean, first of all, Clive had an alibi. At the time the person came by his death, because as far as I'm concerned, he wasn't murdered. He died, clearly, which was tragic, but he wasn't murdered, and there was no evidence of a deliberate act. And he had an alibi, and he was staying overnight at the time the person died in a hotel in Earl's Court in central London. The scene of the alleged crime was in over in Rotherhithe in East London, so it was about an hour away. Clive at the time had been out. He had a bit, I think he probably wouldn't mind me saying, he had a bit of a drink problem. He used to drink quite heavily, and he turned up and checked into the hotel. And the evidence that was given in court was that he checked in at about 10:30 the night. The person died in the early hours of the morning, and Clive said, I was there all night, left the following morning, didn't know about this to this instant till later. So that was his alibi, and he decided, I've got an alibi. That's what I wasn't there, didn't do anything. I'd left the flat. I was heading off to Australia. I'd planned this visit months ago, and all the evidence shows this was a well-planned trip. And he went via the States to Australia. He even left documents that showed in the flat that he'd vacated where he was going to in Australia. So when the police traced him to Australia, this was no magic piece of detective work. It was, you know, he left a trail. You know, if this was a well-planned, execution to claim on an insurance policy, the last thing he's going to do is leave all the evidence for the police to follow you up. So that was his alibi, and because he didn't give evidence, which he's entitled to do, it was all prosecution evidence that was basically unchallenged.
So what was withheld? Because I did have a read of I think it was a Daily Mail article about this, and there were key bits of evidence that were withheld at the time, wasn't it? What were they?
Yes. I mean, one of the things I unfortunately, you know, once you're convicted by a jury in the UK, unless you've got some really new evidence that shows that the jury were not, that there's either a fault in the trial, a procedural issue, or that the jury were not presented with the full facts, which is what the case is with Clive, you're basically stuck there because, you know, most people will go through an appeal. And then the only other route, and the only route now, is through the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which is independent of government, who will decide whether there's something inherently wrong with a trial or there is new evidence that if it'd been presented to the jury, would have created a real possibility that the jury have come to a different decision. So it's that's the test, what they call the real possibility test. But it was years later, by chance, that solicitors acting for Clive discovered that there was material that hadn't been presented to the jury, particularly around the pathology evidence around the cause of death. For example, there were four post-mortem examinations conducted on the person that died, and it wasn't until the third post-mortem that the pathologist for the Crown decided that he thought there was some bruising internally in the body, and he then assessed that this guy had been killed by a technique known as Birkin, rather strangely named after two killers called Burke and Hare that were convicted of killing people for selling their bodies for medical research in 1828. So pathologists for the Crown and the prosecution relied on a case over 200 years old as the basis for this was the cause of death. And of course, first of all, you've got to prove that a person died. You have to prove a deliberate act. The junior pathologist that was relatively recently qualified for the Crown was put up against a guy, a professor who'd had 44 years of vast experience in the same field. And the jury, when you look at all the other evidence that was trailed out that was unchallenged, came to the conclusion that he was guilty. But the nub of it, the centre of it, is the pathological evidence and the fact that notes about the original post-mortem on the first examination the pathologist came to the initial decision that this was natural causes or not a deliberate act. There were some various notes that were exchanged or sent by the police to the pathologist that are rather suspicious. And I have some suspicions there was some encouragement by the police to try and find the evidence to show that this was a deliberate act rather than natural causes, because the police had this, their hypothesis, as it's called now, but their theory that this was an attempt to kill somebody, body double, make sure this guy, the body was burned, and so that they would the police would say, well, this was Clive Freeman, and the insurance policy could be cashed in, and that's the problem of having a single line of inquiry or a single view, is this is what happened, and then you look for the evidence to support your theory rather than having an open mind. Yeah, sorry, James.
Yeah. Tony, we've got a couple of minutes left, so we haven't got long left. But I want to have you actually spoken with Clive.
I see him every couple of weeks. I visit him in prison. We have lots of conversations. I was able to convince the Daily Mail that this was a very worrying case and all the hallmarks of a serious miscarriage of justice. The conviction, as far as I'm concerned, is inherently unsafe.
Now, Tony, like I said, we've only got a couple of minutes, so I need to keep it short. But through your discussions, I mean, what does this do to somebody? 35 years. And if he is innocent, spending 35 years behind bars for something you didn't do, what? I mean, I don't know whether you've talked about this with him, but what effect does this have on a person?
Well, clearly his mental health has been hugely affected, and particularly when he's saying, look, you know, I put my faith in the British justice system and it's let me down. And you know, I refer to this as being stitched up by the state, because it's not just the police, it's the whole prosecution and criminal justice system that's let him down. He keeps clinging on to the hope that at some point he's going to get out. And this is his fifth application to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. You know, I'm representing him. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a former police officer. You know, I know a little bit about the law. So I'm representing him in his application, and I'm his 11th legal representative since his arrest, and I hope it's going to be the 11th time lucky. I'm confident this time that a new review, a lot more information, that this time the Criminal Cases Review Commission will refer it to the Court of Appeal, because that's the only route out for him.
Well, I hope, you know, the truth does come out and you are successful. Tony, you're clearly a guardian angel, I think, to Clive. Absolutely horrendous if he is innocent and he spent all that time. And let's just hope that he gets out. Tony, thank you so much for coming on the Freeman Report. And by the way, you must come back because you've got an awful lot of experience. I'd love to talk to you about other stuff as well. So, Tony Thompson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, James.
Right, we're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Doug Bando. He's a foreign policy and civil liberties expert, and he's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And we're going to start talking about Iran and all the civil liberties abuses going on there. I'm going to ask the question, does he think that we'll ever see the Iranian people overthrow that terrible regime there? So stay where you are, right here with us on TNT.
Not see it coming. It's prediabetes, and it captures 1 in 3 adults. You may not even know you have it, but you can escape. Take the 1-minute prediabetes risk test to know where you stand. With early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
What do I love about riding? It's the thrill. The excitement. riding gives me a sense of freedom. I feel so connected to the road. Riding is like therapy to me. It makes me feel alive. Love riding? Back off.
This is the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, now we have talked about this topic before. I've had people that were actually born in Iran, now living in America, journalists, and they talk about the horrific things which go on there, people being, you know, shoved into the back of vans, public executions and the like. So it's clear there's a lot of civil liberties abuses going on there. So I'm delighted that we're going to have a further conversation about this. My guest is Doug Bando. He's a foreign policy and civil liberties expert and senior fellow at Cato Institute in Washington. Welcome to the Freeman Report, Doug.
Thank you. Happy to be on.
Right, so Doug, let's get stuck in. Tell me what kinds of civil liberties abuses we're seeing in Iran.
Well, this is essentially a dictatorship, you know, under which you don't criticize or oppose the government. They have elections, but basically anyone that we would imagine voting for cannot run. That is anyone who one would kind of classify within the Western system as being even moderately liberal of some sort. Even kind of moderate right wing in the West would not fit within this system. It's very much focused on religion, but it's also the question of the ruling regime. It's dominated by the Revolutionary Guard and a clerical leadership. They use that system to disqualify candidates. So at the start, the governing structure is all focused on one set of people who do everything they can to hold power. Media, you don't criticize these people. You don't organize against them. They impose very strict religious requirements. We've seen that with the question of women having, for example, to wear headscarves, and the fact they will arrest and beat women who don't. That anyone who stands against the regime faces these kinds of things. We see dual citizens come. If you're a U.S. citizen as well as Iranian, or if you're British or someone else. Very often the Iranians pick people up. They use them essentially as bargaining chips. We see that in Russia and elsewhere, but Iran does that as well. And if you look, Freedom House, rates countries in terms of both civil liberties and political liberties, in Iran is way down, near the bottom. Now, it's not the very bottom. I mean, places like Saudi Arabia and others actually are slightly worse, but that, it's in very bad company. I mean, Iran is kind of down at the bottom. When you think of China, you think of Russia, countries like that. This is not a place where the liberties of the people are taken into account. This is one where there's a ruling regime that's been in power for many years. They've continued to tighten their control. The deceased president was basically kind of shoved into power because they disqualified everyone else. I mean, to give you a sense, Ahmadinejad, who was a fairly radical guy, say 15, 20 years ago as president, they wouldn't let him run because they were afraid he was competitive with some of the other, very traditional elites. So they even use it against the people within their own system. Very bad place.
Yeah, and it is a real shame. It's a crime, actually, because the my guests, I forget his name now, but he was talking about the rich culture in Iran, films, music, arts. It has a real rich culture, and actually most of the people are not happy with this regime. I think what you've just described there is the apparatus and the structure, which means that a minority in the country can rule over the majority. But Doug, tell us about some of the more extreme things that happen. You kind of described about the rules. What happens if you break the rules?
Well, you're very likely to go to prison for a long time. The prisons they have, Evan is one. I mean, these are very ugly places. This is not, these are not Western-style prisons. I mean, they're overcrowded. There's torture, which you're likely to face. Executions are common. We saw that coming out of the street protests over the young lady who was beaten to death. Clearly killed by the regime because she did not have head covering. That set off massive protests. A number of these people were sentenced to death. So this is a a regime that doesn't take any kind of opposition well. They have religious persecution. They've had kind of show trials for Jews. The Baha'is are probably faced the worst. Baha'is are, at least Jews and Christians are viewed in a sense of people of the book. Baha'is are viewed as basically apostates. The utter brutal treatment there. They hate converts. Converts face prison. Converts face brutality and torture. It's one thing if traditional ethnic groups are Christian, but for them to have the majority, if you as a Muslim want to change, you'll find yourself in jail. You'll find yourself arrested. You'll find yourself facing torture. Yeah, so this is one where any kind of opposition, any being out of sync in any way with what the regime views as the appropriate behavior, you're very likely to find jail time, very likely to have arrest, likely to face some kind of brutality, some kind of beating or torture. And there's always a chance, depending on what the issue is, you could find yourself executed.
Yeah, and like you indicated there, there has been a pushback more recently. We've seen, particularly with women, after that killing of that young lady who was taken off in a van for wearing not wearing a headscarf. So it seems that the population is getting more confident in terms of pushing back against the government. I guess the question that I'm thinking of is, do you think in our lifetime we will see the people of Iran overthrow the regime?
Well, we certainly hope so, but it's tough. I mean, the problem is for us, we can look at this and say, why don't they overthrow? But are you willing to step out and face the prospect of arrest, of torture, potentially of death? That's why this regime responds so in such tough ways and such brutality to any kind of opposition. They had protests going back a decade or so ago with fixed elections that were very serious. The regime is not popular. They know it. People are tired of the controls over them. The urban population especially doesn't like the religious and cultural controls. A lot of people don't like their money being sent to everywhere but at home. Send it for the Houthis, send it for Hezbollah, send it for Hamas. These are not where if you're in a tough situation, people are living badly because of the economy is a mess, partly because of sanctions, but partly because these people don't know how to run an economy. It's autarky. It's regime corruption is very serious. So there certainly is an undercurrent that wants to get rid of it. What I think we need to see is within kind of the ruling establishment itself, some factions that break away and then are willing to work with a larger population. And that's where it's interesting, where you see the regime moving on its own people, you get a sense that within the leadership, there seems to be some fracturing. To me, that's the best hope, is that at some point you have, and maybe Khamenei is elderly. He's also facing health issues. When he dies, there could very well be a power struggle. We'll see what comes out of Raisi's death. There are three or four people mentioned as possible candidates. I mean, none of them are Western liberals, but a couple of them seem at least a bit more technocratic, a bit more interested in competence. You could see perhaps some fracturing there, but I'm not going to hold my breath. This is going to be very tough. The Iranian people have a lot to get rid of to try to get free. It's a very tough job for them.
Now, Tony, I don't know whether you can comment on this. I don't know whether this is your area of expertise, but dare I say it, I'm sure the US and the British intelligence services are there trying to help that overthrow along. Do you have any sort of knowledge of what the US is doing there?
No. I mean, the question of how effective both the US and Brits will be, part of it is there's a history there. In 1953, London and Washington helped overthrow a democratic government, left-leaning, but that brought us the Shah, and people still remember that. So there's a danger that if you start playing around, that's where the regime then tries to use that, tries to use that to get people to rally around it. So one has to be really, really careful. And I don't know how good our intelligence assets are there. Now, I think Mossad, frankly, the Israelis certainly have shown penetration and an ability to target nuclear scientists and others. Whether they're able to try to do a little more to help organize, and what that would involve, I just don't know. I would suspect they probably try to do something. There may be efforts to create kind of a silent infrastructure where you're not pushing anybody to do anything now, but you're trying to create communication, trying to create channels. So if things start to move, then it might be possible to get communications equipment perhaps into people's hands, that kind of a thing. That could, I think, be helpful.
Yeah, and of course, with the advent of the internet and whatever, there's lots of things we can do without actually having to have agents on the ground there. Doug, apologies for that. What do you make of this helicopter crash this week? Do you have anything to say about that in terms of, you know, we're told it was an accident? I don't know if you've got any information or any rumors that you've heard.
Well, I think given the circumstances of the accident, I'm inclined to think that that's probable. Number one, they don't have new parts for any of their equipment because of sanctions. It's very hard for them to maintain both airplanes and helicopters. So it would not surprise me that they're probably cannibalizing old equipment. They're trying to get things in through sanctions evasion, et cetera. But even for the presidential helicopter, it's certainly possible that the maintenance there is not too good. Where it was flying is mountainous territory. It's viewed as treacherous. They were on the border with Azerbaijan. The foreign minister was along because they were trying to make nice with their neighbor with whom they've had bad relations. Azerbaijan actually works well with the Israelis. So this is a trip that I think was made out of necessity, not because anybody really wanted to fly over there. And apparently the weather was foggy and was a mess. So you can imagine that the president's got to get back. So you fly even if it's bad. So my inclination is to say, okay, the circumstances at least look very plausible. But of course, we have had crashes back, I think it was 1988, President Zia of Pakistan. Almost certainly sabotage assassination. The question with Raisi is who would try to kill him? I mean, so far he seems in sync with Khomeini and the ruling regime. Now there are some who are fearing perhaps that he wants to run for the supreme leadership after Khomeini dies. Nevertheless, would the senior leadership kill its own? I don't see how that helicopter comes down because of an opposition that we would kind of support. I don't think it's liberals out there who have access to a helicopter like that who could do it. It'd have to be Revolutionary Guard. It would have to be somebody in the system. If they start killing one another, that's a very dangerous slope for them. So I my bet would be that it actually was an accident, but this is the kind of system where they talked about a hard landing. I remember thinking, that's a crash. Excuse me, folks. So we won't know. And I doubt we'll find anything out, at least, through the Iranian government in the coming days. They're going to maintain that whatever it is and circle around to try to protect themselves.
And of course, compared to airplanes, helicopters are much more risky as well. So I think probably onto the right tracks there. Now we've only got 3 minutes left, so I'm going to very, very quickly set the context here. So General Charles Q. Brown Jr., he's the chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff, said NATO trainers will eventually be sent to Ukraine. Now, Doug, from where I'm sat, that is a signal of a huge escalation. We know these proxy wars go on. They've been going on for years, decades, even in the Cold War. But it's very, very rare that either party actually says officially, no, we're going to put troops in, because it does have an escalation risk to it. What's your assessment on the situation and the statement he's made?
I think it is very dangerous. I mean, not only are we raising the profile of NATO intervention, we are helping kill Russians. We should be quite clear about that. Russia knows it. The more we make it public, the more dangerous. And what happens if Americans and other NATO troops die? I mean, you're in there training, and we apparently have troops in doing other things, manning anti-aircraft weapons, et cetera. If some of those people die, are the NATO countries prepared to accept that? They're in a war zone. The Russians have every right to target whatever they want. It's going to be hard to complain, but it's also hard to bring body bags back home and explain to people why you don't retaliate. This makes me very nervous.
It does, doesn't it? And what have Russia said in terms of, because, we keep on hearing about red lines, but it seems those red lines do move slightly. Where do you think the hard red line is for Russia?
What I'd say is that the red line moves as long as Russia appears to be winning. To me, this is the thing. We shouldn't get overconfident. If they were in danger of losing Donbass, if they were in danger of losing Crimea, my bet is the red line would be somewhere else. So that's one reason for us to be careful. I think at the moment, Putin doesn't want to go overboard. He thinks he's going to win this. You don't want to bring NATO in. On the other hand, if he thinks he's about to lose it, I think all bets are off. And I think Russians might support that. If they look and say NATO's killing our people, U.S. officials have talked about killing Russian generals and sinking ships. There's a red line.
Yeah, it certainly is, isn't it? It's very, very worrying, I think, particularly because there's many of us who believe that, you know, I don't support Putin and I don't think his regime there is a moral one. But, you know, I think NATO have got a lot of questions to answer in terms of it poking the bear and tightening that noose around Russia. They are almost forcing that bear into a corner. Doug Bando, foreign policy and civil liberties expert, thank you so much for joining me on the Freeman Report today. Thank you.
Fun to be on. You take care.
Thank you. That's it for today. Muckrakers was absolutely brilliant. I'll be back on that on Thursday and I'll be back tomorrow for the Freeman Report. So join me then for another great show on TNT.